This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
The NBA playoffs are here. And with FanDuel, your group chat's about to be going off. Because right now, new customers can bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets if you win. And with live bets, your heart emojis will really be racing from tip-off to the final buzzer. Plus, when you win, you'll get paid faster than your friends can send you a victory gift. Or is it GIF? Who cares? You won! So get the word out to your crew and download FanDuel today. New customers bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets if you win. Make every moment more with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Official partner of the NBA.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the New Books Network. I am your host, Eleonora Mattiacci. Today, I'm here with Stefan Aoni, author of the book Indian Wars Everywhere. The book was published in 2023 by the University of California Press in their American Crossroads series. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to talk about the book.
Tell us a bit more about yourself.
So I'm a visiting assistant professor of American Studies at Williams College. I was previously the Elihu Rose Scholar of Modern Military History and a faculty fellow in the History Department at New York University. And I did my PhD in the American Culture Department at the University of Michigan, working with Philip DeLoria. I'm an interdisciplinary historian of the global United States, and my research interest examines the intersections of race, empire, and violence.
Why did you decide to write this book?
So this book grew out of dual political and academic interests. On the political side, I was motivated by a background in anti-war direct action and solidarity work with Native communities in the Twin Cities in Minnesota. On the academic side, it's an outgrowth of my dissertation. And the dissertation was inspired by a long history of scholarship coming from American studies, ethnic studies, history, and other disciplines. It kind of alleges this continuity between the so-called Indian Wars that accompanied U.S. continental expansion and then later moments of U.S. military violence. So these are people like Richard Slotkin, Richard Drennan, Jody Byrd, and many others. And it always seemed like this scholarship could make a more positive case, archivally speaking, for this continuity. In other words, it was kind of treated like an allegation, but it always felt like there were more archives to plumb to really make a positive case and find the red thread of continuity if it actually existed, particularly with regard to military sources and archives. So in conversation with the above-mentioned scholars and many others, whose work I really love, the book is an attempt to chart whether and how the Indian Wars are, quote, everywhere.
So tell us, what's the argument in the book?
So the book argues that Indian fighting has functioned as what I call in the book a, quote, shadow doctrine of colonial violence. This sort of embedded coloniality that continually intrudes on U.S. military doctrine, strategy, and tactics. And I show that there may not be this explicit and kind of uncomplicated continuity that would take you from the Indian Wars through every major U.S. military conflict up through the global war on terror. In other words, there's no Indian Wars manual that they keep going back to. But despite that, you can chart, and that's what the book does, a series of resonances, discourses, and actions that serve to continually reintroduce Indian fighting back into the formal venues of U.S. military doctrine. And this has been particularly true during moments of so-called irregular warfare, the guerrilla wars, counterinsurgencies that function as this perpetual subscript for U.S. military violence. And this is something that was increasingly explicit during the War on Terror, where the book ends. And so ultimately, this book poses a question that I think remains a vital one. And that question is, what does it mean to treat the conquest of Native peoples as a success story that can be used as a blueprint for modern warfare.
And what kind of evidence do you use to support this argument?
So out of necessity, the book uses a pretty wide range of evidence. Because like I said, you can't just examine a handful of military tactical manuals and make the argument, because the argument isn't there in that venue. And so what I do is I weave together military documents, literary texts, correspondence, different cultural sources, legal texts, newspapers, all kinds of things. And I also pay a lot of attention to what historian David Fitzgerald calls informal doctrine, where the military journals and other spaces where soldiers strategize and talk about warfare, but it's not necessarily written down in explicit military doctrine. As far as archives, I did a lot of research at the National Archives and the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., as well as at the Newberry Library in Chicago, which is a major research library, as well as a wide range of university research libraries and special collections. And so the research is kind of this continual push and pull between what military doctrine was and wasn't saying, balancing more formal military sources against the myriad of other venues I mentioned, where both soldiers and civilians really couldn't stop talking about the Indian Wars in relation to whatever the current conflict was in the United States, or more accurately, whatever the current conflicts were.
Yeah. How's the book organized? Could you tell us a little bit more about the organization of the book?
So the book is split up into 7 chapters, including an intro and conclusion. And the chronology of the book covers multiple centuries. It spans multiple continents. And so this breadth of content is balanced against what I call a series of deep cuts into key moments that highlight this ongoing relationship between colonialism and military violence in U.S. history. And so the story of the book begins with the continental expansion of the United States, and it then leaps overseas to the Philippines for 2 chapters in this kind of Spanish-American War moment at the turn of the century. I then follow these shadow doctrines that have transmitted Indian fighting across time and space, examining the World Wars, the Cold War, and finally, the Global War on Terror. And the book concludes in 2016 at the resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline by the Standing Rock Sioux and their allies. And it ends there because I wanted to show how the counterinsurgencies of the Global War on Terror were then redeployed against indigenous water protectors, kind of full circle moments that makes the case for the relevancy of untangling this knot of colonial violence that really seems to be tied so tightly into the deeper recesses of American militarism.
Great. And what conclusions do you reach in the book?
So the book functions as a history of these traces of colonialism that continue to reemerge in American culture. And it's an examination of the different forms of violence that continually mobilize ideas about race, indigeneity, and security to justify an ever-expanding U.S. militarism. But foremost, the book is a critique of the ways in which the United States cannot seem to stop refighting the Indian Wars, imagined or otherwise. And so ultimately, the book argues that the Indian Wars have, in fact, been everywhere, but that the story of these residences is a bit more convoluted than scholars have sometimes assumed. Indian fighting has functioned as this shadow doctrine that could serve to legitimize U.S. military violence, while continually reinserting the mythologies of U.S. settler colonialism back into doctrine, strategy, and tactics, and overall military discourse. And in particular, Indian fighting has been a mechanism for reintroducing the history of irregular warfare into the U.S. military. In other words, whenever confronted with guerrillas or insurgents, American soldiers tend to reach backward to the history of the Indian Wars to make sense of that present moment. And so that's the book's overall argument.
That is great. Thank you so much for giving us an overview of what the book is about, its empirics, its chapters. We want to go a little bit deeper on some aspects of the book. And so, for example, in the intro, you write, quote, "Indian Wars Everywhere is both a cultural history attentive to the materiality of warfare and a history of violence attuned to the ways culture shapes that violence," end quote. To achieve both objectives, you rely on a vast array of sources, to say the least. For example, in the chapter titled Relearning the Indian Wars, you use the following, and I took notes, so I'm going to read from the notes. You use field manuals, interviews recorded with military leaders, dissertations and theses submitted to the U.S. Army War College, CIA documents, historical magazines, original works for the U.S. military published by the Combat Studies Institute, just to name a few. Can you tell us a little bit more about the process and method through which you chose to put together all these sources? In other words, if we were to sit next to you as you were gathering all this material, what would it look like?
Yeah, so out of necessity, the book had to be really methodologically flexible because I was tracking down these discourses of Indian fighting wherever I could find them. And what this often meant was searching out what the official venues of military doctrine had to say, right? You mentioned the U.S. Army War College, the Combat Studies Institute, and then drilling down into the more informal conversations that were happening elsewhere. Those conversations could have been happening in journals and personal correspondence and interviews and media appearances, really kind of anywhere. And so balancing the formal against the informal and trying to chart the discourses in that way and find the interaction between those two spheres. And so the process often probably looked like panning for gold, right? The way a lot of research does. Trying to find those instances where people were talking about the Indian Wars or talking about Indian fighting. These conflicts are a cultural preoccupation of the United States, and they always have been. So it's not like they're invisible, but trying to find those specific moments that seem to edge more closely into a relationship to ongoing U.S. military violence and see how the Indian Wars are traveling across time and space. I never wanted to assume that there was some sort of influence being exercised in any particular moment. So I always work to find examples where A, the Indian Wars are being discussed or Indian fighting is being discussed. But then B, there's also a clear relationship between those discourses and then the material effects, practices, or actions of the U.S. military and U.S. military violence. It was also a productive challenge to bring the more theoretical tools of Native and Indigenous studies and American studies to bear on military doctrine that typically gets more attention from military historians. And so I really had to walk an interdisciplinary tightrope in this book. And I have to credit my graduate training in American Studies at Michigan for those tools. Because I think those equip me to, for example, pick up a literacy in U.S. military history, which is not something my graduate training focused on. But I learned a great deal from learning that literature and putting it into conversation with a lot of the other literatures I've engaged with. And I think it's also worth mentioning that the bulk of this book was revised during the COVID-19 lockdowns when I was living in New York City, which was perhaps one of the more intense places to be locked down in the early stages of the COVID-19 pandemic. And so I really had to develop a facility with digital archives to make this work if I wanted to make any progress, because I couldn't leave the house, much less go travel to a library to do research. And so I worked really extensively in digitized collections of periodicals, journals, other print sources, in addition to digitized archival materials and digital collections. And so I owe a big debt to all the research librarians that have digitized their collections, because honestly, that enabled this research. And I think it'll be interesting to see a kind of generation of books that were revised, manuscripts that were revised while locked down, because it did force a change in the methodological process for people that do rely on doing archival research.
Well, it sounds like it took a lot of drive, and we are grateful for all the work you put in it, because the book is definitely shows all the love and TLC that it took to collect all those sources.
Thank
you. Let me ask you another question. So a recurrent theme throughout the book, something that emerges in different chapters, is this idea that Americans must sort of relearn to fight by relearning their own counterinsurgency history. For example, you mention it when you talk about Kennedy and his conversations with his advisors. And of course, then you mention it again during the debate surrounding, following 9/11. So why, how is it that we explain what you define as a sort of amnesia, to use your own words? Why does this amnesia emerge?
Yeah, so one of the kind of sub-themes of the book, as you mentioned, is a history of U.S. irregular warfare, which is kind of a blanket term for counterinsurgencies, guerrilla warfare, police actions, small wars. They've been defined in different ways in different times, right? In the early 20th century, they called them the small wars, particularly the British did. But there's always been a kind of coloniality to these conflicts. And so this book is a contribution to the history of the kind of coloniality or the imperial aspect of so-called irregular warfare. And so this relates to my earlier point that there may not be this kind of unceasing continuity of Indian fighting across time and space. There's often been rather a forgetting and a remembering as colonial violence has morphed over time into the imperial police actions, the counterinsurgencies, and the irregular wars of the 20th and 21st century. And that's why I think my concept of the shadow doctrines has a particular kind of utility, because it's useful for exploring those moments in U.S. history where military violence intersects with race and with colonialism or with empire. As these conflicts have often been viewed as quote unquote savage or outside the mainstream of U.S. military action. And so when I was doing this research, I found that there's this persistent tension between the savaged and the civilized aspects of warfare throughout U.S. history. And that tension has often been negotiated through references to the Indian Wars. So the ongoing colonialism that results in the savage wars is perpetually at odds with the desire for a finished colonialism. Civilized war, right? That's the goal of settler colonialism, is to close off the colonial process, declare it finished, and then move on. But of course, settler colonialism is never finished in the United States, right? Because Native people will continually resist that kind of fidelity that settler colonialism often aspires to. And so the friction between these two poles forms an important part of the history of American violence. And what I found is that when the facade of civilized violence slips, Indian fighting has consistently been there to fill in the blanks, particularly in the counterinsurgencies in the Philippines, Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq. And so what I argue in the book is that the currents of American militarism seem to both affirm and forget the histories of colonial violence and the conditions of possibility for U.S. empire. And also part of this history is the fact that irregular warfare has often been extremely brutal. And has been something that the military has occasionally been hesitant to preserve. For example, right, the war in the Philippines, the Philippines-American War. There's a decent amount of institutional knowledge production that happens, and some of that gets actively suppressed because there's controversies that accompany that conflict around the use of the Watergate torture or other atrocities that they're debating in Congress. And so... One of the things I think the military learns is that brutality is an effective counterinsurgency strategy, but brutality is maybe not something that looks so good written down and preserved in formal doctrine. But the kind of more sanitized mythologies of the Indian Wars that have been so thoroughly laundered through films, novels, video games, right, from the moment of the creation of the United States all the way through the present has been a preoccupation of American popular culture. They become a way to reinsert irregular warfare back in any particular moment. And so that's the kind of final payoff of the book, is that I found when looking for what soldiers were saying about the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, they were talking about the Indian Wars a lot and citing the Indian Wars as this precedent as a way to kind of reintroduce counterinsurgency, to find a usable history of counterinsurgency to apply to the War on Terror. Because, of course, as historians like David Fitzgerald, who I mentioned earlier, have shown, the Army in particular wants to pivot away from counterinsurgency after Vietnam, right? They want to fight the big war, the technological war, right? The kind of Desert Storm template, the Colin Powell template. But they find themselves occupying Afghanistan and Iraq in 2004. And so they go back to find a history of irregular warfare, and what they find is the Indian Wars.
Sounds very interesting. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. I wanted also to ask you, what surprised you the most over the course of your research? For example, was there like a moment when you thought you'd find something, but instead you found something different? Or Were there any surprises along the way?
Yeah, I mean, one of the challenges, but one of the occasionally affirming aspects of doing such wide-ranging research is that you find yourself looking at all these nooks and crannies you didn't expect to investigate. And so there are, you know, many moments actually where I ended up finding something that kind of demanded to be included in the book that I never would have imagined finding or including in the finished manuscript. So a few examples. In chapter two, I end up taking this detour into the children's literature that's being written in the early 20th century. The publishing syndicates responsible for celebrated franchises like The Hardy Boys or Nancy Drew are also publishing what I think we might, in kind of contemporary parlance, call young adult novels, where young American children kind of follow the contours of the burgeoning American overseas empire in the late 20th century. And so there's these novels where young boys are following some of the soldiers that I'm finding and writing about in the archive. And they're using U.S. empire as a kind of tool to train young American boys how to be men, right? There's all this anxiety about masculinity in the early 20th century. And so I end up having this whole riff about children's literature that was unexpected, but totally fits into the overall argument, because these novels continually draw connections, in particular between the Indian Wars and the American occupation of the Philippines. Another example, I ended up wandering into this debate about firearm ammunition in the early 20th century. So there's this conversation about bullet design and bullet caliber that the imperial powers are having in the 20th century. The British start using what they call a dum-dum bullet, which is an expanding bullet, which opens particularly brutal wounds into bodies when the bullets impact, because the lead is exposed at the tip. And so the British are making this argument at the kind of, you know, conventions about the rules of war, international law, that this bullet is necessary for so-called savage war. And there's kind of this weird imperial solidarity uncovered between the United States and Britain at that time, right? Because even though the expanding bullet isn't formally adopted by the U.S. military, you have these soldiers writing in these journals saying, we need this bullet for the Philippines, right? Just in the same way that the British argue, you know, this bullet is required to stop a savage in Africa, right? To use their words. American soldier is saying, we need this bullet to stop the Filipinos, right? Because normal wounds don't stop, quote unquote, savages. And so, you know, I'm not really a gun person, but I had to learn a little bit about the kind of history of firearms to make this make sense. But it's just one of the many examples where the debates about warfare, particularly debates about, quote unquote, savage warfare, get filtered through the language of the Indian War. Another example. So during World War II, I found that this Native organization in New York City, it was kind of a support organization for the many urban Native people working in factories, working in the high rises and so on. They declared a Warrior of the Year three times during World War II, maybe more than three times. But I know that they at least gave the title Warrior of the Year to Stalin, MacArthur, and Eisenhower. And wow. There was even a ceremony where they gave a feathered war bonnet to Douglas MacArthur. He was in the Pacific at the time, so it had to be accepted on his behalf. But it's this really striking moment where Douglas MacArthur receives this feathered war bonnet. He's declared Warrior of the Year. And then he gives this statement where he says, well, of course, we're using the Indian War tactics in the Pacific as we fight the Japanese, right? Which may have not been explicitly true in reality, but the kind of mythology is enough to kind of structure the debate about the contours of American violence at the time. And then, you know, maybe the last I'll mention is that it was kind of a surprise to find out just how many soldiers the U.S. military's command schools, right, Fort Leavenworth, the U.S. Army War College, were thinking about and writing about the Indian Wars during the Global War on Terror. You know, we kind of had more overt resonances, right? George Bush's kind of thing about being a cowboy, right? References to the Crusades. But in really kind of technical language, soldiers are excavating. This is how they fought the Apaches. This is how they fought the Lakotas. This is directly applicable to what I'm doing in Afghanistan, what I'm doing in Iraq. And so Yeah, that was some of the best evidence that at least American soldiers are really thinking about the Indian Wars everywhere. And of course, the kind of ironic subscript to the book, even though it's not my focus, is that Native peoples have consistently had some of the highest rates per capita of enlistment in the U.S. Armed Forces. You know, the first Native woman to die, or the first woman to die in Iraq, is a Native woman, Lori Piestewa, Hopi woman. And so I do try to gesture at moments in the book to the kind of sub-history of what I'm talking about, which is of course, Native military service, right? Lots of Native people serve in World War I before Native people are declared citizens by the United States. And so, yeah, that's not maybe the preoccupation of the book, but it's something I gesture at key moments.
It sounds like a lot of surprises. Thanks for sharing with us. We've taken enough of your time. I'll ask one final question. What are you working on right now?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I'm trying to get over kind of post-book fatigue and move on to the next project. So I do have a project I'm thinking about, which I'm, you know, provisionally titling Year in the Life of a Cluster Bomb. Wow. And I'm interested in bringing together a history of cluster munitions as they're used during the Cold War, activism and organizing in opposition to the manufacturing of those bombs, and then the relationship to environmental pollution. I'm from Minnesota. That's where I grew up. And the Honeywell Corporation in the Twin Cities was a major manufacturer of cluster bombs. And they met a lot of resistance by activists in the Twin Cities. And so I would like to bring together kind of local history of where I grew up and place it in relation to a more global history of a particular kind of weapon being used during the Cold War that continues to have lingering effects. And so that's where I think I'm headed next. I think it's a project that can bring together my very interest, right, kind of global U.S. history, Native and Indigenous studies, more local U.S. history, cultural history, in some interesting ways. And so that's what I've been working on next.
This just sounds like a great project. And if I may add, you have a knack for interesting titles. So, and that's always hard to do for books.
I'm glad I was able to reuse, because they always say the danger is don't use your good title for your dissertation, because then the publisher won't want to reuse it. But I used my good title for my dissertation, but thankfully with some tweaks, we were able to reuse it again, because I think I was never able to think of something better than Indian Wars Everywhere. So I'm glad that's the title of the book.
It's a great title. And the second book and second project has a great title as well. Thank you so much for talking to us today. My guest has been Stefan Oni, author of the book Indian Wars Everywhere. The book was published in 2023 by the University of California Press in their American Crossroads series. I am your host, Eleonora Mattiacci. Until next time.